Now, the moment you've all been waiting for.
Testing, testing, check, check, check.
Hello there, this is funny lady Judith Lucy.
Hi, this is Joel Creasy.
Hey, this is Fiona O'Loughlin.
Hi guys, McLaughlin here, that would be of the Craig variety.
Hi, this is Shayna Blaze.
Hello, this is Tom Ballard.
Hi, this is Melissa Capp.
G'day, this is ScoMo, Scott Morrison.
Hi, this is Reece Nicholson.
Hi, it's Gina Liano from The Real Housewives of Melbourne.
Hi, this is Reece Mastin.
Hi, this is JC Fox.
This is Kathy Griffin.
Hey, this is Todd Collins.
Hello, this is Weird Al Yankovic.
Hello everybody, it's Omar Rudberg and you're listening to The Troy Murphy Show.
Troy Murphy laughing at me in the other studio. Oh, he's dancing to my radio vet. Hello, Troy.
The last couple of shows I've listened to the Troy Murphy Show, I've nearly had a couple of accidents because my eyes have been watering with laughter so much.
Is it me? Am I the problem? Surely I can't be the only one that thinks that the world is going bananas. With doctors last summer claiming the term morbidly obese to be ditched. Look, I understand morbidly obese is not a glamorous term, but unlike the morbidly obese lifestyle, one should not have to sugarcoat everything to explain that it's problematic.
He's ready for his close-up. It's the Troy Murphy Show.
Ladies, gentlemen, them, they, and all, including those who I hate listening, and I know you're listening. I know you're listening because I hear about the complaints each week. I must be doing something right because I'm both the most complained about show here at the station and also the most listened to show here at the station, as evident by our on-demand statistics, which I've spoken about week on week. I must be doing, you know, we have our AGM coming up soon. I think it's, what, not next week, the week after. Maybe, I think there's still time. Maybe I should put in that I want to run for general manager of the station. The position, I think, is available. Could be available. Who knows? But because I do radio so well, being the most listened to and most complained about show, maybe I should run the station as well, you know, pick up the rest of the shows. Oh, the facetiousness of my radio show. It is an opinion-based show, so whether that opinionate is right or wrong, who knows? It's there for the enjoyment of many who listen to the show each week. Thank you so much for tuning in. Without your listenership, this show wouldn't be what it is today. Of course, Thursday nights, 7 p.m., it is time for the Troy Murphy Show. A big thank you to BJ and Grossi and the Bumper to Bumper team for their brilliant show. I just love following these guys because they do great radio and it's so enjoyable to follow their talent. On the show tonight, I was going to say, speaking of talent on the show tonight, we're going to talk about one scientist who thinks that the Matrix might just be real. Yeah. We'll also talk about female frogs and how they're avoiding unwanted male attention. Pay attention, ladies. This one's for you and gentlemen who sway that way. We'll also have the quick quiz. We'll also take a look in our serious part of the show, the Israel and Palestine conflict. We'll explain the history of it so those who don't know understand what's going on. And of course, we'll take a look at the voice referendum. I should point out, last week we did have Yes 23 here on the show for an entire hour. I extended that exact same time for this week's show. I emailed Senator Jacinta Namba-Jimpa-Price, asked her to come on the show. I emailed Fair Australia, I asked if they wanted to come on the show. I also directly emailed Tony Abbott, who is one of the prominent no vote people. No one got back to me. The offer was there. They didn't respond, which I take that they declined the offer. They don't really need it. They're winning in the polls at the moment, so probably don't need the attention. All that and so much more coming up on the show tonight. And as we always say, and with that, let's dive headfirst into this week's show without any safety gear on, of course, because that's how we do things here on the Troy Murphy Show, responsibly. Don't try this at home. Or if you're another radio show, maybe try it to get the listenership. Your choice.
Follow The Troy Murphy Show on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram and Threads. Search The Troy Murphy Show.
All right, let's do it. Let's have some fun. Let's do some weird, wacky and wonderful news from around the world. Now, have you ever sat there and wondered, is this real? Is this all real? Or is this all made up? Well, in a world teeming with technological advances, sometimes, just sometimes, very rarely, but sometimes, scientists come forward with theories so bizarre that they seem plucked straight out of science fiction. Do you remember Keanu Reeves dodging bullets in slow motion in The Matrix? Yeah, good movie. But according to a scientist, his name is Melvin Vopson, an associate professor in physics at the University of Portsmouth. Well, The Matrix might be what we're living in. Unwitting actors in an elaborate virtual spectacle. Yes, this scientist, Melvin Vopson, well, he's presented a reality, or lack thereof, where our existence mimics the behavior of a computer deleting or compressing code. Yeah, I'm a little bit confused by that myself, but let me continue. He suggests that we're not living in an objective reality, but we're merely characters in a super advanced virtual reality simulation. That's one hell of a virtual reality situation if we're all backup characters. Quite a wild thought though, isn't it? What's more, he bases this on a new, and I quote, second law of information dynamics, which apparently contradicts established physics by asserting that disorder in a system of information decreases over time, not increases. I'm not really following the bouncy ball here, but that probably says more about my intelligence than what this guy is talking about. Maybe that's why he's the associate professor in physics at the University of Portsmouth or Portsmouth, and I'm not. But we are told to hold on to our virtual hats if you're wearing one, because here's where it gets a little bit trippy. This Vopson guy, he believes the symmetry observed in nature from butterflies to crystals is actually evidence supporting this simulation theory. According to him, and I quote, symmetry is the best way of optimizing or rendering the digitally constructed world. Well, I guess it's easier to do something that's symmetrical. You just copy and paste either side and there you go. Bob's your uncle, or your virtual uncle. Now, is he outrageous or just simply out of touch? Well, the most mind-boggling part of all this story that's come out this week is that Professor Vopson claims that, and I quote again, the entire universe might be just a super advanced virtual reality simulation, end quote. This bold statement not only challenges our understanding of existence, but also seemingly reduces the marvel of life and the universe to a mere line of code in an alien system. Is this scientific inquiry or a pitch for a Matrix sequel? That is the question that needs to be posed to this professor. And I tell you what, if this, just a personal commentary here, if this is indeed a virtual reality simulation, can someone control, alt, delete on some of the nasty stuff that's going on in the world right now? We don't need this. If we're just Sims in a game, come on, make it easier for us. We just want to walk down the street and enjoy ourselves. marching along, singing a song, just being background characters. Anyway, let's continue back to this news story that's been reported this week. Many online have expressed their skepticism. You can also say someone on radio is expressing their skepticism too. One Twitter user asks, quote, do these scientists think we're living in a video game? What's next? Respawns. I don't know what that means. Another one quips, just because you can't explain something doesn't mean it has to be a glitch in the Matrix. End quote. Oh, I like that. Yes, exactly. Maybe there is a God. Maybe there is. Who knows? Logic tells us there isn't. And the fact that I'm a self-proclaimed, is it atheist? What's the other one where I don't believe in anything up there? Anyway, let's take a look at this. Let's analyze this simulation hypothesis, the scientific grounding of it all. Well, Vopson claims rely heavily on theoretical and speculative physics. The actual empirical evidence supporting the data, and that's the data that we're living in a simulation, is scant. And the correlation is not actually causation. And that the similarities between information systems and certain natural phenomena, like butterflies and the crystals like we mentioned before, don't really confirm a coded reality. Well, the code that we know. Maybe it's a more advanced system. Who knows? The philosophical debate behind this, the simulation hypothesis, is as much a philosophical argument as it is a scientific one, much like is there a God? It raises questions about consciousness, reality, and the nature of existence that science alone can't answer. Maybe he's just, you know, explain how God's doing this whole thing. Whichever God you prescribe to, just put the code in the computer in there. The implications for humanity as we analyze the simulation hypothesis. If we entertain this theory, what does that mean for human agency, spirituality, and our understanding of life? It risks undermining the tangible experiences and struggles of life by attributing them to a pre-programmed system. And you've kind of got to ask yourself, if we're just Sims in the background of some sort of virtual reality simulation. A, who's the main character? And B, well, then we can do whatever the hell we want if this is real. Who cares? If we do the wrong thing and it's against the programming, well, then we get deleted. Maybe that's the reason for death. Who knows? Scientific contradictions. As we analyze the simulation hypothesis, Vapson's second law of information dynamics stands in direct opposition to established scientific principles, particularly the second law of thermodynamics. I know I'm nerding out here, but I've done my research on this. One new theory does not negate centuries of validated scientific understanding. And if you're going to take anything out from this, that's probably the big take home that you should take home, because this is just hypothetical and we have theory that has been around for centuries and has been validated scientifically. Now, the need for proof. The most significant hurdle remains the lack of concrete evidence. There is none. Until the proponents of this theory, this professor, and that maybe the simulation theory provides substantial proof. Like, I haven't been seeing any glitches, unless it's got some really serious RAM behind this computer program. I haven't seen glitches yet. It remains fascinating, a bit outlandish of a concept as a whole. Now, to wrap this up, because we've nerded out scientifically for a little too long here on the show, and we've got other things to talk about, while Professor Vopson's simulation theory makes for an intriguing sci-fi plot, it veers sharply from established scientific consensus. It's essential to maintain a critical eye and seek concrete evidence before subscribing to such fantastical notions. After all, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Although, a bet to that, and saying that, We really have no evidence of a god, but how many people around the world believe in different deities? Anyway, so for now, it's safe to say we're probably not living in the Matrix. Probably. If I'm not here next week, or if there's a problem with this show broadcasting, then maybe there is a Matrix. it's one of those philosophical, psychological, mind-melting conversations that I'm sure I will enjoy having with my friends at a later date. You are listening to The Troy Murphy Show. Matrix indeed.
Fun stuff at the front, serious stuff at the back. You're listening to The Troy Murphy Show.
As part of our fun stuff at the front, serious stuff at the back dedication here on The Troy Murphy Show. Oh, have you ever wondered if nature get it better than what we do as mankind? And when I talk about nature, I talk about the animals. And when I talk about animals, I talk about the lengths one has to go to avoid unwanted attention. Now, while we humans might opt for a fake phone call or a sudden dramatic exit to the bathroom or ghosting someone, or what's the new term that the kids are using nowadays, zombied, female frogs, yes, female frogs have leapt to astonishing heights, or should we say dramatic lows, to dodge the amorous advances of their male counterparts. And how do they dodge the amorous advances from their male counterparts? Well, they straight up fake their own deaths. Ha, ha, ha! You go, frogs! Now, get this. Research spearheaded by the evidently unflappable Dr. Carolyn Dittrich revealed this shocking behaviour, amusing behaviour, smart behaviour among European common frogs. Quoted, she said, it was previously thought that females were unable to choose or defend themselves against male coercion, which sounds a little Me Too-ish if you ask me in the frog world, but unknowingly setting the stage for the greatest aquatic rom-com for all time, it turns out that a whopping 33% of these femme fatales would rather play possum then pucker up with a not-so-charming Prince Charming. But wait. Here's a croak-worthy tidbit. This tactic, known in scientific circles as tonic immobility, was first scribbled into a notebook somewhere in 1758 and then conveniently forgotten. Talk about a secret survival diary indeed. And whilst you there listening are probably sitting there flabbergasted and somewhat amused by this evolutionary escapade and probably wondering, I wonder how I can include that into my dating life, there's a jarring undercurrent here. Isn't it outrageous that even in the animal kingdom, females have to resort to such extreme strategies to skirt around coercive courtship? It's a swampy reflection of society's broader issues, isn't it? Hashtag that is me too. Now, online chatter is ablaze with disbelief in regards to, well, this old but new information. And, well, dry humor has overcome these findings. Quote, "Forget me not," tweeted one user. Quote, "I'd rather fake my own funeral than date some of those frogs too." Hashtag relatable, another one quipped. And finally, a third tweet that I found that is amusing. Quote, "Next time a creep slides into my DMs, I'm going full frog on him." End quote. Well, there's a new phrase. There is a new phrase of vernacular that I guarantee you we're going to start seeing pop up. Stuff ghosting, stuff zombieing, we're going to be frogging them. We'll be frogging the unwanted advances. Now, jokes aside, I know I've been a little bit humorous in this let's leap into some critical analysis of what is going on here. And the number one point is it's ingrained survival tactics. Female frogs' use of tonic immobility signals an ingrained survival tactic, hinting at a problematic mating ritual that can be coercive or even harmful. There's also historical oversight here. The fact that this behavior was first observed in 1758 and then brushed under the lily pad points to a historical oversight in understanding animal behavior, especially concerning female responses. Look, let's be honest, it was probably a male who decided to bury that scientific behavior, or maybe people just didn't care that much about frogs. There's also the anthropomorphic reflection of all this. The parallels between human and frog behavior can be humorous, as we've had a giggle at, but it's also there to serve as a stark reminder of universal challenges faced by females across all species, not just in the humankind, but the animal kind too. And then there is the conservation implications. How might such behaviors impact frog populations and conservation efforts? Are there ethical considerations that need to be taken here for researchers? Maybe that's why, frog populations are diminishing. I know I'll hashtag be me too'd for this, but maybe the female frogs are just going to put out and grin and bear it for, 3.5 minutes? Just to keep the population going. Who knows? And of course, there is a social commentary when it comes to critically analysing this story. Ultimately, this discovery is not just about frogs. It's a commentary on consent, bodily autonomy, and the lengths that females go to ensure personal safety and, their taste as well, be that human or amphibian. So next time you're at the pond and you witness a dramatic, in quotes, death, remember, it may not just be a Shakespearean tragedy unfolding before your very eyes, but rather a female frog's bid for freedom. And maybe, just maybe, together as a society, animal and mankind, we can work towards a world where no one, amphibian or otherwise, has to play dead to feel safe from the unwanted male attention. Hashtag that as a funny rant over. You're listening to The Troy Murphy Show.
From Cronulla to Como, The Troy Murphy Show, broadcasting live on the Shire's very own 2SSR 99.7 FM.
All right, let's do it. The most popular segment on demand for The Troy Murphy Show, and that is the quick quiz. We've got 10 quick quiz questions. You get to play along as we do it here on the show. You've got 3 seconds after I ask the question to lock in your answer before it's revealed. And of course, messages on the Troy Murphy Show Facebook page with how many questions you got correct. And I'll give you some trophy emojis in correlation with how many you got correct. Let's start with question number one. There's a few easy ones in today's quiz, and this one is it. Proverbially, two people who are completely different are said to be like chalk and what? The answer we're looking for is cheese. Question number two. Who is the longest serving current state premier in Australia? Anastasia Palaszczuk. And Queensland, do you have some answering to do? Question number three. What is the common medical term for high blood pressure? The answer? Hypertension. And don't I have that myself? Indeed. Question number four. Hass is a common variety of which fruit? The answer, avocado. Moving on to question number five. Which fictional character describes himself as, and I quote, a bear of very little brain? I'll give a hint. It's Disney. The answer? Winnie the Pooh, of course.
Now, the customary procedure in such cases is as follows.
Excuse me, Owl, but what does crustamone proceed cake mean? For I am a bear of very little brain and long words bother me.
Hell.
Question number six. Arabica and Robusta are the two most commonly grown varieties of what bean? Arabica and Robusta. The answer? Coffee! In fact, you probably had one this morning. Or are drinking one tonight because you have a show to do and it's late in the evening and you need energy after working all day. Question number seven. Cameron Diaz provides the voice of Princess Fiona in which animated film series? I told you there was going to be some easy ones. The answer is Shrek. And didn't she do a good job?
Very nice, Shrek.
What? I told you coming here was a bad idea.
You could have at least tried to get along with my father.
You know, somehow I don't think I was going to get Daddy's blessing, even if I did want it.
Well, do you think it might be nice if somebody asked me what I wanted?
Sure. Do you want me to pat for you?
You're unbelievable.
Question number eight. Which futuristic animated TV comedy series created by Matt Groening and David X. Cohen is set in the city of New York? Futuristic animated TV comedy series. The answer, Futurama.
Valentine's Day's coming. Oh, crap. I forgot to get a girlfriend again.
Guess I'll do what I always do when I run out of booze.
Question number nine. Of the eight planets in our solar system, remember that eight, which is the furthest away from the sun? The answer, Neptune. Question number 10. In which Australian state is the site of the Eureka Rebellion? Which Australian state? The answer to question number 10 is Victoria. How did you do? Did you get all 10 correct? Or did you get the average, which is about 5 or 6, which is still thumbs up? Or did you do terribly and only get one or two? Either which way, let us know on the Troy Murphy Show Facebook page and I will give you a little trophy emoji for the amount you got correct. That's the quick quiz. You are listening to the Troy Murphy Show here on 2SSR FM 99.7.
He's as fruity as a bowl of Fruit Loops. You're listening to the Troy Murphy Show.
Let's now take a look at one of the biggest breaking news stories that we've seen this week, and that is the Israel-Palestine conflict. Now, it is such a tragic story. Any news story or any event in the world that has the loss of innocent life, including young children, is horrific. No matter what the reason for the conflict, no innocent child born into this world should have to face the kind of death and destruction that is going on in Israel and Palestine. Now, I'm not going to go into all the news stories because your mainstream media is covering it at verbatim and at length, and you've probably had more than enough of that. What I thought I'd do here on the show is, well, look, these news outlets kind of treat your average person like a bit of a mug. They don't go into too much detail about the conflict. They just say, this is bad, this is good, this, you know, and there has been a lot of bad going on, including the protests that have been happening across the country. No one should ever protest the death of others, or especially protest in support of a terrorist organization, which is Hamas. Now, I thought regularly here on the show, we do a little segment called Explained. And I thought I would simply explain the Israel-Palestine conflict. Now, it dates back to the late 19th century, and it's a complex territorial and nationalist dispute that has been the focal point of Middle Eastern politics for decades. And it's rooted in both historical claims and modern-day geopolitics. This strife has led to multiple wars, innumerable clashes, and lasting tension between Israelis and Palestinians. Now, the origins of the conflict. There is so much to go into, but I'll try and keep it brief so we can keep it to one segment. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, both Jewish and Arab national movements emerged in the Middle East, seeking self-determination. For Jews, this was epitomized in Zionism. Zionism is a movement advocating for a Jewish homeland in what was then known as Palestine, a territory under Ottoman rule. Now, following World War I, Britain assumed control of Palestine under the League of Nations mandate system. During this British mandate, the Balfour Declaration of 1917 played a crucial role by supporting the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine, causing apprehension among the Arab majority. Now, that leads to the creation of Israel and the immediate aftermath. World War II's devastating impact, especially the Holocaust, intensified global sympathy for Jewish refugees. In 1947, the United Nations proposed the partition of Palestine into separate Jewish and Arab states, with Jerusalem as an international city. Now, while Jewish leaders accepted the proposal, Arab counterparts did not. In 1948, Israel declared independence, triggering the first Arab-Israeli war. By its end, Israel occupied more land than initially allocated by the UN, leading to a significant Palestinian exodus known as Nakba, which translates to catastrophe among Palestinians. And there's been continued struggle since then. The following decade saw multiple conflicts. The 1956 Suez Crisis, the 1964 Six-Day War, the 1973 Yom Kippur War, and more. The Six-Day War was particularly transformative, with Israel capturing the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, Sinai Peninsula, and Golan Heights. While Sinai was returned to Egypt after the Camp David Accords in 1979, the status of other territories remained contentious. Now, the Palestinians under the Palestine Liberation Organization, known as the PLO, later known as Hamas, which is recognized as a terror organization across the world, continued their struggle, leading to two infidels, uprisings, and various skirmishes. Now, there has been plenty of efforts towards peace. Over the years, there have been multiple attempts to resolve the conflict between Israel and Palestine. The 1990s Oslo Accords between Israel and the PLO were a significant milestone, establishing a framework for future negotiations and leading to the creation of the Palestinian Authority. However, final status issues like borders, refugees, settlements, and Jerusalem's status, the capital city, have remained unresolved. The current situation. Today, the Israel-Palestinian conflict remains unresolved, with both sides holding deep-seated grievances. The vision of a two-state solution is increasingly challenged by Israeli settlements in the West Bank, security concerns, and Palestinian factionalism and mutual distrust. While peace remains elusive, understanding this shared history is crucial for fostering dialogue and seeking a future where both Israelis and Palestinians can coexist and thrive. But knowing this history and what has happened in the past, I guess one could have some sympathies for the Palestinian people, but that does not excuse what has happened and has started this week with the loss of innocent lives of Israeli people as the war intensifies. And I don't think this is going to be a war that ends quickly, as stated by the Israeli people. And I also feel there is much more to learn about this with other parties involved in this conflict. The best we can hope for is for, well, peace talks to begin and respect. Respect from both sides, but more so respect from the Palestinian people over the tragic loss of life, including in countries around the world. In the news this week, we've seen Palestinian protests in capital cities across the country, including here in Australia, in Sydney, in Melbourne, where, again, I just can't go past, whether it be a protest or a celebration of the death of innocent people, especially children. That is uncalled for, that is evil, and we as a country should not stand for that sort of behaviour. It doesn't matter what the historical impact has been on modern day thoughts and processes. Civilised people should never, never celebrate or encourage the death of innocent people. This has been a mess from the beginning. It's a mess today, and I hope that the world leaders are able to come together to find a resolution and a solution for peace to move forward. And there we have it. I hope that helps you get an understanding, a better understanding of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as just a brief overview of the history to what got us to where we are today.
Put your serious hats on. It's time to take a look at the big stories breaking this week.
You know, it wouldn't be a The Troy Murphy Show in the past year without talking about the voice to Parliament. As stated earlier in the show, we did extend this hour of the program to the No campaign in response to last week's Yes 23 or Yes Voting side in the aim of balanced reporting. I sent an email to Senator Jacinta Namba-Jimpa-Price. I sent an email to Fair Australia and also a direct email to Tony Abbott himself. Neither have replied, and well, neither should they really. They're winning, according to the polls. They don't need the publicity. So an effort was made to have them come on the show to talk the full hour for balanced reporting or fair time to either side on the program. However, they, by not responding, have declined. But that does not mean we cannot, well, not talk about the voice to Parliament, because it's only 2 days away. This Saturday, we get to vote in the referendum to see whether Australia says yes or no to the Indigenous voice to Parliament as proposed and put forward by the Albanese Labor government. And I'm sure next week's show, we are going to be unwrapping the results and giving opinion on why it succeeded or why it failed. Probably more the latter. Now, in the final week of waiting until we get to vote, of which, if you don't know where to vote, head to the AEC website. They have all the polling places listed, and they also have the pre-polling places if you want to go tomorrow and vote early, of which a record number, I think the last number I heard was 3.5 million Australians have pre-polled in this referendum, which of course all that gets counted on the night. It is only the mail-in forms that get counted after the fact. So we should know on Saturday night which side has won, the yes or the no. And I tell you what, being a political geek that I am, I will be sitting in front of the TV. On one side, I'll have probably the ABC, and on the other TV, I'll probably have Sky News, and I'll be watching both channels to see their coverage, because I believe in balanced, absorbing balanced media, so one can take the points from both sides and come up with a more cohesive middle ground opinion or analysis of anything that the news reports on. But to the voice, as Australia finds itself into the throes of the voice referendum, a glaring piece of data released this week disrupts the narrative spun by the Yes campaigners. Seat by seat modelling, seemingly a beacon of truth amidst the turmoil, suggests that the Yes campaign is gasping for breath and is only set to triumph in a mere 22 of the 100 House of Representatives seats. Now, the House of Representatives, that's the green room, which we always see. That's where they have question time down in Canberra. And of course, there are 151 seats, so people there representing electorates. Now, here in the Sutherland Shire, we have two electorates. One of them is Cook, where Scott Morrison sits, and the other is Hughes, where Liberal MP Jenny Ware sits. However, this paltry victory seems clustered around inner city seats. Now, I'm talking about the victory of the Yes campaign, where they only set to win a mere 22 of the 151 House of Representative seats, according to data released this year. So where people are voting a majority in yes are clustered around inner city seats such as Sydney. And the inner city seats such as Sydney include seats held by none other than Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and Environment Minister Tanya Plibersek. Now, in saying that, having a UK firm help us form clarity on an Australian socio-political issue has raised a few eyebrows. But like I said before, the method was applied in 2022 and its accuracy was commendable. But even though precedent was set, can we really rely on past accuracy as a predictor for future correctness? Well, no, we can't. And critics online have also voiced similar sentiments, with one Twitter user stating, "Outsourcing our political destiny to foreign analytics now, are we?" While another one quips, "Focal data's accurate method sounds like a fancy crystal ball reading to me." And yes, if we've learned anything in history, is that, well, you can't always trust the polls. It happened in the US, it happened in the UK, it happened here in Australia, where the poll said one thing and then, well, something completely different happened. But to reflect on Australia, it was the quote-unquote quiet Australians that elected Scott Morrison as Prime Minister. But that also had to do with the mistake, I guess he would call it a mistake, that Bill Shorten made when he gave the price tag on how much it would cost to go green as what lost him the election, and the polling was done prior to that. Now, the poll predicts an absolute landslide for the no case. In particular, an absolute landslide for the no case in several Queensland states. And I intend to look at this next week on the show to see how well it did, as some of the numbers are starting to look like cricket scores rather than polling results. Thought I'd throw in a little bit of a sport analogy there just for those who like sport. Now, Bob Katter's seat, independent minister, Bob Katter's seat of Kennedy is at a staggering 84.9% no. Nationals leader David Littleproud's seat of Maranora is at 81.5% no. These aren't just majorities. This is massive opposition to the Albanese Labor government's proposal for a voice referendum. Now, the data gets bizarre, really, because you come down here to Sydney and in Tanya Plibersek's seat of Sydney, well, she leads the yes charge with a majority of 70.4% stated to be voting yes in the referendum, followed by Anthony Albanese's seat of Granler at 64.5%. The yes campaign, it seems, is the stronghold for those who walk in the corridors of power, detached from grassroots reality. Either that or it's just inner city guilt or separation from rural Australia, but most likely the guilt of closing the gap. Or maybe just inner city people are all for voting on the vibe of it all. A quote we've quoted numerous times here on the show in criticism of the Albanese Labor government's attitude and marketing tactics of The Voice, where rather go with fact and detail, we just go with the vibe of it all. Although that is a pretty sweeping generalization. Putting it simply, the closer you are to CBDs, whether it's Sydney, Brisbane, Hobart, Melbourne or Perth, and alleging that it seems to be more people voting yes where elsewhere in the country is no, well, that is a bit of a generalization, but that is a pattern that we're seeing. Correlating geographical locations with political insight or empathy. Look, I'll slap myself on the wrist. It is a little oversimplistic and reductionist. The notion that wisdom is geographical is absurd and dismissive of the complex socio-political fabric of Australia as a whole. My bad. But, you know, if the shoe fits. Now, this is a distinct issue. Objectively, several key points have emerged from it all. With this data, we are relying heavily on a UK firm for Australian political forecasting, and that's kind of questionable, considering the unique political landscape and dynamics of Australia. Yes, voters, I'm giving you a little bit of hope here. Now, the stark divide in voting patterns between urban and rural areas highlights not just a political but a deep socio-cultural rift in perceptions and priorities. It's a divide that any government or policy maker must acknowledge and address on the other side of this referendum. The overwhelming no vote in rural areas signals a disconnect between the policies proposed and the people they are supposed to serve. Because let's not forget, it's in these rural areas that we find the divide greater, the closing the gap divide greater with Indigenous Australians and foreigners. And it suggests a bit of a failure in communication or policy design that resonates with these communities, which of course is probably a reason why the voice should be a thing, but where the Albanese government failed and how you can fail with the millions of dollars that has been given to the Yes campaign from corporates across the country, well, I think it just goes to say that the Australian people aren't mugs. We want facts. We want details. Something I have thought of as a bit of an analogy of why Albo went this way is back in 2022, Bill Shorten shot himself in the foot by caving in and giving details on the cost of transition to green. This election, Albo barely scraped through. He only won the election thanks to preferences. So that's other people who got voted for and their vote point or whatever it is got given to Albo, and therefore he became Prime Minister and the Labor government were elect. Albo wasn't fully over the detail. You remember there were a few media questions where he stumbled on knowing or being across the detail, which lost him points and potentially votes. So some detail was given in that election. A lot of that was wrong, like the $275 power cuts. That's something you're going to hear every time there's political discussion. Which, of course, side note, one of the reasons why I am probably leaning more towards voting no at this referendum on Saturday. I'm still undecided at this point, but I am, as I've always said, heavily leaning towards the no vote, only because Albo said, you know, vote on the vibe of the whole thing. No, I'm a details man. Please come on, Albo, treat me like an adult. And it's also the fact that Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has said that, you know, vote for it now, we'll give you the details later. We'll make it work. It'll all happen under us. And well, judging on his track record, I'm all for precedent and things like that. He promised us so much at that election. He was elect by the Australian people to deliver on those promises. He didn't deliver on them. How can we trust him to deliver on this voice should it be constitutionally enshrined? I'm all for, I'll get this out there before anyone cuts any part of this segment and sends it off to the other media or to ACMA or whoever. I am all for recognising the Australian Indigenous people in the Constitution as our First Nations people. I'm dubious on putting the voice that for me is unplanned and we don't quite know the detail and there's sketchy detail about what is actually required or will come from this voice into the Constitution, so it's there. Should have been legislated from the beginning, and there should have been better consultation between the Labor Party and the Liberal Party to come together to put it as a policy that had both sides agreeing on it going forward. You would have brought more Australians on board with you for this campaign. And finally, the Yes campaign's stronghold in areas associated with political power raises concerns about the out-of-touch leadership and the potential elitism of this proposal. Something I could go on forever talking about, the elitism of Canberra and politicians. Now, whilst simply predictive modelling for the Voice referendum, this polling does paint a picture of not only a nation united in transformation, but one also divided. Again, Albo said this would unite Australia. It has certainly divided us. Perhaps in the aftermath of all this, the Labor Albanese government and all political parties can reflect on this and see that the proposal failed. The proposal failed to resonate with the masses. And it is my opinion that it failed, and this is an opinion show. The proposal for the Voice referendum failed because there was lack of detail. And last week, I know the Voice activist said, well, if you don't know, go and research it. It's all out there. Well, you would think that if the detail was out there and you had the millions, the war chest of money, you would make it easy for people to find this information if it was so important to vote yes. I have said this on another program, and I will say it again on here. Last week's show, whilst I did want to just have a show to give the Yes campaign an opportunity to come on to talk about the Yes vote, I did ask them the hard questions. I didn't want to go too hard on them, mostly because they played a pretty good chess piece. They had an Aboriginal man come on the show and do most of the talking. And could you imagine... could you imagine that the Daily Mail or the Telegraph the next day, white radio host racist for going hard on Aboriginal man supporting voice referendum? That would have been the headlines. That would have been the headlines, which is, again, a gross reflection of society it is today. It's where I felt as a presenter I couldn't go too hard. And there were so many follow-up questions that I had of the things he was saying. You should have seen my notepad as we were chatting for that hour. I had all these questions, but because of the fear of being cancelled or being labelled as a racist, I held back because, well, I didn't want the headache. But back to what we're talking about, which is this polling that has gone electorate by electorate across a country that has seen only 22 of the 151 House of Representative seats in favour of the Yes campaign, and all the others mostly in a almost 50-50 split, a little bit higher than 50-50, in favour of the No. Well, whether these predictions manifest on Saturday or the weekend remains to be seen, but they certainly lay bare the unbelievable aspects of a campaign struggling for air outside the political elite's bubble. And a campaign that had so much money. It is unbelievable how much money they had, including from our banks. And according to these polling, I've just been talking about the seat by seat, the electorate by the electorate data. They also did a nationwide result as well, which went 61% no, 39% yes. Which, when we continue to look at the graph there of the decline in yes votes, this has to be, without a doubt, the lowest the Yes campaign has been, just days away from the referendum. Now, even though Anthony Albanese, our Prime Minister, says this referendum is not about one person, this was meant to be his moment, his crowning achievement as Prime Minister, and his lack in foresight, his lack in planning, and by treating the Australian population as mugs, this voice referendum will be his downfall. And unfortunately, it will further disadvantage the Indigenous Australian population in this country. I predict there will be calls for Albo to hang up his hat for the damage he has done to this country by dividing us so drastically on one single issue, and the damage he has done for what could have been an easy solution and an easy fix to help close the gap across many of life's markers for the Indigenous Australians of this country. Hashtag that as a very long-winded rant over. And however you vote this weekend, remember, remain respectful, keep it civilized, and above all, let's hope that politicians learn a thing or two as a result of how this was handled. You're listening to The Troy Murphy Show.
And it's all over, just like that.
And that's it. The Troy Murphy Show done and dusted for this week. Thanks for tuning in. I'll be back next week from 7 p.m. for more ranting and raving and serious analysis of the news of the week. Don't forget, you can listen back at any time by heading to the 2SR.com.au website, finding the Troy Murphy Show on the live program guide and clicking the on-demand player to listen again or listen back to at your convenience. Until next week, my friends, bye for now.
2SR FM 99.7.